today I would like to talk about snake handling. When I was 20 and first time in Bodhgaya, on the other side of town, which was much more like a village at that time, the second monk in charge of the Burmese monastery went in the night to the bathroom, and he said he saw this. He saw what looked very much like a cobra standing up. And so the snake handler was called from the nearby village. And I think we could learn a lot about the way this guy handled snakes. He started by singing to them. And he sang a really nice song to them. He said, "It's not safe for you here. Come with me. Come here. I'll take you where it's safe." And so a snake came out, but not alone. There were two of them, two cobras, one male, one female. And he put his stick down, and they wrapped around the stick, and he put the snakes into his snake bag. So now we know we need a stick and a snake bag and a nice song. Of course, by that time, even though it was a small village, the whole village had come out to watch by that time. And so he got the snakes out again. And he started playing with them, showing off. He got bitten. He didn't mind. He had the remedy. A certain kind of root, which I really wish I remembered the name of, but I don't. He just applied the root onto the bite. And then he realized, I think I better put these snakes away. So back into the bag. And his agreement with the snakes is that he takes them to the mountains where they can have enough space to be snakes and not get killed by people who are so afraid of them. There's a kind of a rule with snake handlers, or a belief or a legend or something, which is if you kill one cobra, its mate will come back and get you. If you kill the male or the female, the other one will come back and get you. So this story is a true story, and it's also a parable about us. So just to be aware of a few different things that we do when we're trying to handle all that we call life. First of all, that it really helps if you have a really sweet song. And what your intention is not to kill, but to invite and actually take away to a safe place where there's enough space for that energy or that thing to be itself. So there's somehow a trust in your own life that there is a space for all of that energy once we find the right place for it. And maybe we need to be careful. If we do find ourselves killing the male or the female in us, just noticing what happens the next night. I'd like to read a poem by Mary Oliver called Mindful. I won't read the whole thing, just parts of it. Sometimes we orient ourselves towards the practice of mindfulness, looking to kill something and find safety by killing, rather than seeing if we could find where there's enough space for the wildness. So Mary Oliver calls the poem Mindful. So there's actually a poem called Mindful. maybe mindfulness is not so dry after all, if there's a poem. And she says, every day. So the first two words of the poem are every day. I see or I hear something that more or less kills me with delight, that leaves me like a needle in the haystack of light. It is what I was born for, to look, to listen, to lose myself inside this soft world, to instruct myself over and over in joy and acclamation, which we could say praise or appreciation. Nor am I talking about the exceptional, but of the ordinary, the common, the daily presentations. I say to myself, how can you help but grow wise with such teaching? Such teachings as these. The untrimmable light of the world. The oceans shine. The prayers that are made out of grass. So I'll just read the first part again because I like it. Every day I see or I hear something that more or less kills me with delight, that leaves me like a needle in the haystack of light. It is what I was born for. In English, we have this image of the needle in the haystack, and I don't know if it's in other cultures, but it's something that's really hard to find. So in that kind of atmosphere of maybe being willing to lose ourselves, to be killed by delight rather than trying to kill this delightful life. Still, there's the question, how do we handle this life? How do we handle the things that make up this life, even? How do we even handle the things in our lives? How do we actually handle the things in our lives? How do we actually handle our cup? Or our socks. How do we handle things that I call mine? And how do we handle things that I call yours? And a very interesting question on retreat is, how do I handle things that we call ours? Or the retreats? Or nobody's? What's the difference in the quality? Depends on our conditioning, our personality. Some people are really careful with their cup, and if they have to wash yours for you, you better wash it again. For others, it's the opposite. They'll wash yours for an hour and just rinse their own cup out. But when it comes to our cups, the cups that don't belong to a particular person, apparently, it's very interesting to see what happens and how often they disappear. Even to see while traveling in India, because most of us, not including myself, are travelers in India, and spending a lot of time in hotels or guest houses. So how do I treat the bathroom that belongs to someone else's hotel that I paid for? And sometimes living that way, where we feel I'm in someone else's place, but I paid for this, I can use it the way I want. Sometimes it makes our lifestyle of traveling kind of gray. We don't think of putting a flower. We don't think of getting a pin and cleaning out the calcium from the shower head so that it actually comes out of the shower in more than one place. It only takes about 5 minutes to do that, in case you'd like to have a shower in India sometime. Just any kind of pin. So the thing is, it's really hard for us, I've noticed, to ask ourselves questions like these without feeling a sense of blame coming. Under the shadow of blame, we're looking to find out, how do I treat my cup, and how do I treat your cup, and how do I treat our cups, and how do I treat the hotel's cup? With a sense of, somewhere I'm going to get in trouble if I really look into this. This is what I've noticed. And I think that it's not enough just to notice that, but to try to feel why. Why, if I see clearly, does there need to be blame hanging over, waiting to land somewhere? So I hope that I'll remember to go back into that in a little while. If not, you can go into it in a little while. So what about how we handle other things in life, like our inner experience, like anger or judgment? How do we handle comparing thoughts, feeling inferior? What do we do with that? Are we supposed to express it? Are we supposed to suppress it? Are we supposed to do all of this work on my own? Or am I supposed to get help and do it with help? Am I handling my inner life by believing in the teaching, or believing in the practice that I'm doing, or believing in the process that I'm a part of, that I'm in my inner life? Or am I supposed to doubt? Is it by doubting? And I think that we could learn from the snake. So we say, on the one hand, I could express my anger. I could go tell the managers how upset I am when I see people talking around the place. Or I could express how much I love the silence by going over to those people who are talking and talking to them, telling them not to talk. I could express. Or I could hold it in under the name of trying to feel it and go into it and feel the feeling in the feeling, as Christopher said. So on the one hand, express, on the other hand, repress under the name of feel. Because I'm afraid to get it wrong, or that it will be wrong if I really feel it, I don't just feel it, I need to express or repress. Call it what you will. So we say, on the one hand, on the other hand, and the snake says, I don't have any hands. We make a lot of false questions for ourselves. That is essentially just wasting our time. And it's not, again, oh, we're so bad that we waste our time questioning. But maybe we could love ourselves, or at least love life enough to try to find out why. Why am I content to sit around avoiding the anger by deciding, should I express it or repress it? It seems to me that we are working under a basic suspicion of life, in the same way that we have a strongly, many of us, maybe not all cultures, but many of us have a strongly conditioned suspicion of snakes. I remember one time I was taking care of a farm for a couple of friends. And the basic idea was that their goat needed to be milked. But they also had a snake in the house, in their house, a pet snake, a boa constrictor snake, who needed to be fed rats. And which I didn't know when I accepted the goat of King Jaffa. And I thought, you know, maybe the snake will just go on a diet this week. Or maybe my friend can do that part while I go and water the plants. I can water the plants and you can give the rat to the snake, okay? So we made friends with the snake before the owners left. And it is a really beautiful snake, incredibly beautiful snake. Maybe you've seen boa constrictors around, and they're just really gorgeous. And as I was reaching towards the snake to hold her, I just was like flashing Adam and Eve, kind of thing. Don't go with the snake. Snake is bad. It was amazing, because it was such a beautiful creature. And there was this big no coming. Very nice skin. Not only beautiful to see, also to touch. And that snake actually taught me this huge lesson. Because it just so happened by what Christopher doesn't like to call grace, which we could call coincidence or luck, that the snake wasn't hungry that month and hadn't had a single rat to eat in 7 months. So I was thinking snake, rat is gone, snake is full. Snake is digesting or whatever. I just assumed if you put a rat in the cage with the snake or even in the room with the snake, the rat would be gone within seconds. But only if the snake is hungry. So there are times in the snake's life where it does eat more often. But this was a 7-month period where it just didn't feel hungry. And the woman who was called the owner of this snake, Domi, would just every once in a while check it out by putting a rat in the cage for the night. And I thought, you know, you put a rat into a box this big with a huge snake for a whole night, and the rat is living in the morning. This was a different life from what I had gotten used to in my thinking mind. It seems to me that we have all been hurt. And having been hurt, there's a closing down or a closing off that happens next. And we don't realize that it's not every day that the snake eats the rat. It's not every time that we're caught in the box with the snake all night that we disappear. 7 months may go by. I feel like really wanting to talk about this point and feeling that it's very difficult to feel and to express and to go from there. But I still want to try to express this. It seems to me that we've all been hurt and that we've pretty much all closed off from life to some extent. And that is why we can just sit around wondering, should we express or should we repress on the one hand and on the other hand. We're playing, but we're not really playing. We're playing around. We're not playing in the sense of gambling, which is what life asks of us. Where we know for a certainty, death will happen someday. But what this snake taught me is that death will not happen until death happens. And so what to do with that part before the death happens? How to handle that? I think and I feel and I see that we take the pain that we have felt, the loss and therefore pain, or just the pain and therefore pain that we have felt, we take it as a kind of blame and not just as it is. At least this is what I've noticed, so just check for yourself. Terrible things have happened, and then we kind of freeze into that accepting or recepting. Terrible things can happen any second, and this is true. But they don't happen every second. Can we unfreeze? How can we unfreeze? Gandhiji also pointed this out. When he was trying to help people trust a non-violent way of life, he said, even though there's violence in life, overall, life is non-violent. Just look at the newspapers, he said. So this is this brilliant mind looking at the newspapers. I look at the newspaper and it's the tendency to feel, oh my God, so much violence. So much sensationalization of this violence as well. This is where my mind tends to go. And Gandhiji said, if it's being reported as news in the newspaper, it must be an unusual phenomenon. And so we can notice that when there's a war or a crisis, the unusual phenomenon that's reported is someone was saved. Someone was saved from the falling building or the bomb. But mostly the news is who did die. There wouldn't be enough space for all of us who didn't die yesterday. So it's not that we're saying that death doesn't exist or doesn't happen or doesn't matter. It's not, on the one hand, death doesn't matter. On the other hand, death is the only important thing. But how can we live with a life where death is a certainty, but not until it happens? If we could find a way of looking without blame, and how could we do that? Several people, actually many people, have mentioned over the last week noticing themselves wanting to see clearly, but not wanting to see clearly at the same time. Hoping to see clearly, and terrified of seeing clearly. Seeing clearly means seeing whatever is there, even if I've been blocking it out my whole life. It could be anything. So we hope and we fear to see clearly. J. just another kind of way of not quite living, isn't it? And yet it's not our fault that we want to see clearly and we don't want to see clearly. If it's not our fault, then we're free to feel, why am I afraid of seeing clearly? And what is it in my hoping to see clearly? What is that made of? Am I just looking for a happy picture of me, or a picture that fits my story of me? And so I'm afraid if I see something that doesn't fit my story of me. In that hoping to see clearly, is there also some kind of very snaky alive, really sincere wish, any way to see clearly, any way to love life, even though there's death? And what would help us to sink into that? Sincerely wanting to see clearly, even if it doesn't fit what I think is happening or should be happening. We're hurt and closing off has happened. And yet, we love life anyway. It's terrible. Can't escape. What would help us not to take our experience quite so personally? What would help us not to feel it's all on my shoulders? It's either all my fault, or I did it right this time, therefore I've got to keep doing that. So much pressure. What would help us take the shame out of feeling what we feel as it is? I see shame as a kind of stake, like a huge nail in the ground. And all the difficult emotions that we experience, whatever they might be, whether it's frustration, irritation, anger, arrogance, self-negating, fear, inferiority, insecurity, anxiety, loneliness, whatever. Those emotions seem to me just to be a rope, that only when I tie the rope to the stake am I really stuck. I see shame as that big nail, that stake in the ground, and we tie the emotions to that. And it's not a safe place for that energy. Sometimes we decide that what we're going to do is go looking for a big snake, go looking for a big difficulty. And sometimes by the very looking, we scare the snakes away, stomping around. And sometimes, as in one story that is told by Rumi, we find a nice big old snake that's dead. We think, great. Here's a big old snake, one big old difficulty, and it's dead. I can go show everyone how I killed this dragon. And we drag it into town. And people actually come and look at it. This is sometimes what is called satsang. Or teaching. Look at this big snake that I killed. And so many people gathering around and even paying to see the snake. This big dead snake that someone heroically conquered. And all of the warmth of all of those people, and a little bit of sunshine falling on snake, and it wakes up. What would make us do such a thing? Why are we looking for something to show? And why are we looking for someone to show us something like that? A dead snake. Not why with Lane, but otherwise we're just going to be, on the one hand, and on the other hand, playing around. To see clearly whatever is going on and whatever is to be ready to be insulted, which means ready to drop the story I'm telling. But it's so delicate. So the Buddha talks about how easy it is to mishandle even the teaching. And he says, the teachings themselves are like a big old snake. We go looking for teaching for some reason. And sometimes we find them. And maybe we need to get a sense of how powerful the teachings are or could be, so that we don't just grab it by the tail. Or step on it, or whatever. One way that we generally, daily, on a daily basis, if not hourly and minutely and secondly basis, one way that the teachings tend to be misused. In this case, this example, the teachings of no self. We might have heard people talking about no self. We might have heard people talking about non-ego. And I hope that we wondered what that means rather than jumping to conclusions. Very, very often, on some kind of deep assumption level, we play with the idea of no self. And let it be used by a very kind of basic hatred of ourselves and of life. Hatred of ourselves and of life. Which is not no self. But we don't want to hear that. One simple, simple example, any negative emotion comes, we feel guilty. Even though I did not create that negative emotion, the way that I'm experiencing it in my body is probably learned from my mother and my father, facial gestures, etc., copying exactly my family. And we don't really know what the experience is. But we feel guilty anyway. If we could feel the gift of our experience every day as not exactly mine, it's mine and it's not mine. So we can't say it's not mine on the one hand. And then the next day, on the other hand, it is mine. We could just copy the snake instead of our parents and be handless, not handling, just not handling the situation. unless we find a song that says, come here. Where you are, it's not safe for you. Come and wind around this stick. Come into this bag. And I'll take you where there's enough space for your wildness. Where you can go and eat a rat, not because it's been handed to you, opening to some kind of bigger life, where we're not all the time exchanging, doing bargains, saying, I'm not really sure if I want to see clearly, so could you show me that big dead snake that you're telling me you caught in the mountain? If anything, looking for those people who aren't showing off a big dead snake, who maybe are just humming and walking down the road with a stick and a bag. We could notice about ourselves if the tendency is more so-called male or more so-called female. So we have qualities that have been assigned to one hand and qualities that have been assigned to another hand. And which hand do we tend to try to use when we're handling life? Are we using a sense of power and confidence or yielding? And what would happen if we bring those together in the middle? What happens when we bring those together in the middle is deep meditation. Snaky deep meditation. Snaky deep walking. Snaky deep sleeping. If we could stop trying to make deals. I gotta do it on my own. I gotta get help. What about bringing those together in the middle somewhere? What happens, for example, when I go for help, I go to the teacher with the attitude that I cannot ever do it on my own, with the conditioning that if I try to do it on my own, I will either fail, which means get kicked out of life, or I'll be made fun of, judged, ridiculed, which means being kicked out of life. Or I'll just straight away be kicked out of life. That's one kind of conditioning. If I try to do it on my own, I'll be kicked out. In the form of being judged, being laughed at, in the form of what seems to be failure. And so I'm compelled to do what seems to be asking for help, but isn't actually receptive to help. This is one kind of making a deal, which is a hatred of life and oneself. And eventually, if a teacher agrees to that deal, we will hate that teacher eventually too. Just as miserable an option on the other side, where I've got to do it all myself. If I ask for help, I'll be kicked out of life. Another kind of conditioning. another kind of playing around. Playing around with life without living it. Out of a very deep fear that because death or hurt or pain or loss happened that time, could be happening. It could be happening now. We have a connotation, we have a feeling with the word personal. If someone gives a personal touch in their work, it's a good thing, the way that we use the language. And if it's impersonal, it seems to be negative. Someone does their work in an impersonal way. Someone speaks in an impersonal way or in a personal way. They have different feeling tones, different atmospheres to go along. So I was trying to think of a word that means not personal, without sounding like a cold machine, impersonal. Maybe we just have to get used to a different atmosphere with this word impersonal. Or when we decide that we're tired of all of this hoping and fearing, hoping to see, fearing to see, hoping to be seen and fearing to be seen. And one person yesterday talked about hopelessness happening to him. And what a relief. How much more clearly he could see. So hopelessness sounds terrible. But maybe it would be the best thing that ever happened to us. Impersonal sounds terrible. But maybe we need to feel a kind of impersonal, or another word would be anonymous, some kind of anonymity that includes the personal. So it's not either or. I would say that this hopelessness or this impersonal, or this being anonymous anger coming anonymously to an anonymous person, coming right into the heart because we're not pushing and pulling in our usual ways. I would say that this bigger life not only includes the personal story even, not only is included, but this bigger life loves even the personal. Loves even anger. Even the snake. Sometimes people use this word non-duality, and they say, my ego was there, so I was in duality, and then I was in non-duality. And I'm thinking, that looks like two things to me, somehow. And I thought the word non-duality meant not to. Somehow. So Kabir said, trying to describe this big old life, and he said, more or less, if I say two, it isn't so. It's not true. If I say two, It's not true. If I say one, it's slander. It's speaking badly of what is true. And then he says something that may or may not be helpful. If I say two, it's not true. If I say one, or even one, it's also insulting the truth. So then what to say? He said, as it is, so it is. That's the end of his poem. I'm just going to repeat some of this poem. Every day, I see or I hear something that more or less kills me with delight, that leaves me like a needle in the haystack of light. It is what I was born for. To lose myself inside this soft world, in joy and acclamation. Nor am I talking about the exceptional, but the common. How could I help but grow wise with such teachings as these? The untrimmable light of the world, or we could just say, that light. The ocean's shine. The prayers that are made out of grass. Just finding those little openings here and there, where despite ourselves, we're open anyway to life, where that light just kills me. May all beings, including ourselves, be fresh, be handless, be truly, happily alive, be hopeless, and be as we are, so we are. May our gathering here together be a momentum, a big old snaky momentum, towards awakening everywhere. Thank you very much for being here. Those who I have the pleasure and the honor of spending these days with all day and all night, I really thank you for being here, for your generosity to yourself and to life. And for those who are coming all the way across that mad town just to hear some words in a stuffy room, really thank you. It really gives something necessary for us. And please enjoy that feeling that only you can have by coming from outside, where you can actually feel the silence that's happening here, because we're in the middle of it and we don't feel it. So you can appreciate it more. Also, there's an empty box where money could go inside to help pay for our food, donation to the monastery, transportation for the teachers to come here, and so many other things that make this, call it grace or happening or coincidence, such a delight. So it's time for standing or walking or sitting or lying or going to the bathroom or having some water. And just let it kill you with delight. Just human beings on the earth. What else?